And domain name hijacking is also avoided through some effects like mediation before arbitration and waiving of the arbitration fees for the current domain name holder. In the case of IDN adoption, the local dispute resolution policy was capable to handling the surge of conflicts that were generated with this. Since 1997, our electronic contract, domain name service agreement, was supported only by the good faith of the users. But with time, new laws were generated, like digital signature, for example, and the electronic document law, and the Consumer Protection Act, the Consumer Protection Law included these new elements. The penetration of .cl domain names in Chile is widespread. We only have second level, so the population in Chile prefers these short addresses. And only 5% of the websites in the country use generic extensions like .com, .net, .org, or .biz, or whatever. In the matter of IDNs, the complications for using them, these many browsers that has disappointed the users because who cannot see properly the websites in the browsers cannot resolve the electronic addresses, and IDN cannot be used for emails either. The exception. All this part that I told is about self-regulation. The exception in Chile that we have a few and very tiny regulation is the interconnection of ISPs. Even though the smaller ISPs had established an interconnection point called NAP Chile, no one of the larger ISPs were connected to it. In practice, this meant that most of domestic traffic had to be routed through expensive international links. This situation remains until the Telecommunications Authority, the Undersecretary of Telecommunications in this case, mandate that they should interconnect locally. Only in few cases has the government authority felt the need to intervene. In fact, there are only 3 decrees from the Undersecretary of Telecommunications which cover issues about interconnection of ISPs, level of quality of internet connection for the users, and the way that information has to be published. In other area, issues about consumers had to be faced, and the consumer protection law was modified, including rules and effects about electronic contracts. I will tell you something about successful examples for the government sector. This is a kind of regulated activities, like a taxes activities. The SII is the service of Servicio de Impuestos Internos, is a tax collection entity. They require employers to run this process and using and force in many way to the users use internet for doing these taxes things, they required employers to declare electronically taxes withheld to employees. They encourage taxpayers to file tax returns electronically by giving longer deadlines and earlier refunds. They provided ready to submit tax returns for most taxpayers. And this year, for example, the 70.3% of taxpayers filled electronically their taxes declaration. Conclusions? In our experience, it's not that all issues have to be addressed by the government. We had the opportunity to work with the collaboration of the government, in the sense that it look for self-regulation scheme and only with the technical and thin regulatory actions in the industry. ISPs, ICTs are committed to the internet development as a whole. Civil society, government, and industry are continuously having communication in order to achieve the country's goals. We expect that the most issues will continue to be addressed through self-regulation, continuing the tradition of minimal governmental intervention. Muchas gracias, obrigada. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very interesting presentation, and very interesting case of internet governance in a country which is a developing country. So we would like to take some questions about the presentation, if there are some.
Hi. My name is Nishal. I'm from Internet Solutions in South Africa. And I have a question about the interconnection policy. Hi. Okay. So I have a question about the exchange policy at the IXP. Now, you mentioned that this was the only time that your telecommunications ministry interceded and mandated that all IXs connect to each other. And if I'm not mistaken, we heard in the presentation at the internet exchange points yesterday that, in fact, all the regional internet exchange points in Brazil are mandated.
I'm listening to you.
You can hear me. Okay, can you hear me again? Sorry. And we heard in the presentation yesterday on internet exchange points that all the regional internet exchange points are mandated to connect to each other. So that's obviously true, right? Is that a policy that you intend keeping going forward? I'm asking from the perspective of being involved in an internet exchange point in South Africa, and also because from the models that I've read, interconnecting regional internet exchange points doesn't seem to work. I'm curious as to how you see driving this forward. How do you see the ISPs themselves, particularly the larger ISPs, gaining long-term benefit out of this? How do you see them growing and supporting, if necessary, the smaller ISPs? Just to be clear, I understand why you mandated that the smaller, or rather the larger ISPs interconnect with the smaller ISPs. I'm just curious as to what your future path is on this.
Well, I can answer from the Chilean experience, because in the region is different. It's not mandatory to do things. In the case of Chile, the problem was that the user were in that days were few, not so spread in that days when the decree was given. Okay, and the idea was that there was three ISPs very big, and there's five or six very small. So the idea of the authority was mandate them to connect to the real facts are that the small ones couldn't have connection with the bigger ones, and the problem was that the traffic, if they don't connect it between each other, the traffic was by United States. So for the consumers, especially from the perspective of the consumers, the connection was so slow, and there was not good quality for the consumers. So the authority thought that it's mandatory for the in benefits of the community that the bigger ones receive to the small ones in connection. And the traffic could be resolved locally. That was the idea from the in the authority. And now, well, obviously the market, you can force, the authority didn't want to force so much the market. But also the small ones in that days are normally buyed by the bigger ones' companies. So now the traffic, it's locally working. And the quality of the service at the end for the consumers is quite good. But that was the reason why they passed this decrease. It is answered your question?
I think one part of the question is also, are you planning to keep that regulation, that enforcement of the government forward as now they are connected? Are you planning to keep it, right?
Yeah. It's still working. Nobody rejected, and it's very tiny. It's really very tiny. So from the perspective to the consumer, it works quite well.
Okay. Just to add on to that, is the NAP in Chile connected to any other NAP in the region, into the Brazil? NAP?
I think so. In that days, the bigger nets in the country and in the region, in Latin America, were universities, academic nets.
Okay.
So there is a mixture, because in the beginning of the internet in Chile, the academic nets grow faster than the private or ISPs nets. Yeah. So currently, the NAP and the academic nets are more or less working together, giving services to each other. And when the academia grows in Latin America, there was a parallel work in the sense of the net, but in terms of interconnection, it works giving services.
Okay, thank you. Other question? No, I do have some question though. Maybe while people are thinking of question, you talk about the NIC Chile, which is an independent body from the government, I guess. What is the model, the governing model of NIC Chile? How all the stakeholders participate into it? How have you developed your dispute policy? Because according to the presentation, it helps avoid a lot of problems. So how do you get into there to put everybody together to get?
Well, actually, we are something like public entity, because we are inside of the University of Chile. So NIC Chile in the real world, NIC Chile is inside the University of Chile, so it's more or less the same thing. In the case of us, to run the registry inside put us in an arena that there is accountabilities as most of the governmental entities in the top level, which is it's a controller entity in the governmental of Chile, and the second thing is that when the registry start to run in 1987, there wasn't we did this job per 10 years for free, and when the domain names registrants grows, was necessary to have a kind of contract services. And in that opportunity, one of the conditions of the agreement, service agreement, is that you apply to a local dispute resolution policy, as many of CCTLDs or GTLDs has. And that was the was very interesting, because the authority in that days was expecting what could happen in matters of internet in the country. And it's quite interesting, because we were successful for the consumers in to have cheap domain names, because it's not expensive. And the second thing is that if you have a problem, like a dispute about domain names, this is not expensive too, because this is short-term to between mediation, arbitration, and the end or resolve the dispute. And the second thing is that they don't need to go to the court, because the court is normally a very, very long-term to resolve these disputes. That's the reason why. So the community, at the end of the day, the community support this model, especially because for their interest, it works quite well.
Thank you. Any other question?
In fact, it is not a question, it is just a comment. It seems to me that this model looks a bit like the Senegalese model, because NIC Senegal is more or less also like that. It is also hosted at the level of the university, and also it is also open to other stakeholders. And it seems to me that it is functioning well. It's functioning well. This is maybe contrary to what is happening, for example, in my country, my own country, that is Benin in West Africa, where it is like the incumbent operator, telecom operator, who is doing it, who is managing the NIC, just because I think everybody, people don't bother about it, in fact, because the internet is not so well developed, so people don't bother about it. And also they don't want really, in fact, there to have transparent mechanism to allow people, for example, to have access to the domain name. For example, there is no transparent model to have, if you want to have the domain name .bj today, first of all, you don't know, you cannot really do it quickly. It will take some months, and you don't have a clear and transparent model, for example, web-based, to have access to that. And in Togo, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the situation is that it is the private sector that is managing the NIC. So I think there are very, very diverse situations. And for me, it seems to me that the situation where the university is managing it is maybe the best so far, at least for Africa, I don't mind. But I mean, Adiel can also add on to that.
Yeah, I mean, for the domain, it's an issue in most of the developing country because of the structure behind it. That's why I was asking the question about the model, the governing model of the NIC as the background of the first registration of CCTL in many countries, developing countries mainly, take different paths, like as he's saying, incumbent sometime, sometime a private sector, sometime the association which has been set up, sometime they are outsider who register the domain and transfer it. So it's very interesting to know what is going on in that regard. I still have another question related to the government involvement in the internet development in Chile. You, in your presentation, you talk about three different law taken by government. One of them is the quality of service to user in top of the exchange point stuff. So what does that regulation or that law really is about? Which kind of enforcement does the government put to the ISP in terms of service to the user? Because I mean, normally when you are doing business, you have a service, quality of service. You want to support your user because more they are satisfied, more you get business. But why does the government have to step in to talk about the quality, and what are the what is the content of that law? What is the requirement for ISP?
I think the idea was a kind of coordination between the law consumers or the rights of the consumers and the quality of service that they could get.
Okay.
So the authority thought that it's necessary to have informed the consumers. In this arena, when they put this decree and run this idea, they forced to the ISPs to have a level of quality, and also they have to publish the level of the services that they are being given, in order to consumers they could get the information, and if you need to feel something like a demand or something like that, yeah, you can do it informed. That's the best. And this very interesting thing in this arena, because the ISPs are not a big number, so they compete a lot for the clients, the consumers, and the undersecretary of telecommunications forced them to show their services. So in the competition in the market, it's not very it's good looking to have a bad service. So I think in the market happened something very interesting, that they want to challenge for the clients. So they have to show the results. So it was very interesting we can't account if they are saying all the truth in and nothing but the truth, but it's very helpful to the consumers.
So if I understand what is about transparency, I mean it's a law who enforces transparency from the service level, so that they can know. That's, I think that is very interesting because it's something that is not common in developing country in general, where provider care about showing or selling based on the quality or quality of service, and the concept of government enforcing ISP to do that is something I found very interesting, and the practice which can be really shared and picked up by other country. So okay, I've been asking too much question. I think I should leave the floor question for the floor. Any other question on this interesting presentation? Yes.
Just a question. I think your model is an interesting one, and I'm sure that some developing countries, for example, in West Africa or in Africa, may benefit from it. So my question is, do you think or have you been engaged in mechanism or process which can bring about some collaboration with some, let's say, African, to speak about Africa, African NIC, to share your experiences? Do you have you been engaged in experience like that, or are you planning, are you willing to do that?
Actually, I'd love to. No, in the case of our country in particular, well, Catalina is in the first line, and she's the representative of the government of Chile in matters of telecommunications. And we love to, because we think that it works. It's just because it works. So probably the best way to do it is that you can see what is in your community. I think it's very sensitive to the community, in which this model fits or not fits depends the community. What is the role that the organizations or the authority has, and if you can see if it works or not. But we are always available to share it. Yes, the answer is yes.
Yeah. I think that question is very important, because we coming from a workshop where we were talking about South-South collaboration and cooperation in terms of internet governance. So I think a case like this are good to be shared. And honestly, I like that enforcement of quality of service. It's very important that providers start thinking of their user in developing country. Again, I have a question now. Another question about the IDN. Yes, because you've said in the presentation that there are some frustration. I mean, some frustration which make people not really using IDN about the mail which is not working, or browser which does not accept IDN character. So, do you have a specific program to solve those issues, to communicate more with, end user, but also with people who provide browser, or develop your own tool which can support the IDN so that you can grow the use of the local language, make better use of IDN? Or how do you cope with that locally in terms of governance?
Okay. Let me see if it works. The answer is yes. We had a very strong campaign to put this information in the community. I think we were working in the implementation 1 year and a half, and the campaign to share this information was 2 months before to run IDNs. I can show you if it works. a website that is called Ñandú. Ñandú is a kind of ostrich, that Latin American ostrich that we have. And let me find Ñandú. Ñandú. Ñe is a Spanish letter. The IDNs in Chile Spain is just running IDNs in Spain since October, I think, a few weeks ago. Ñandú. Perfect. And two IDN's characters. The Enye is the first letter, and Nyandu, it's a U with accent. And I can show you. We made a campaign with advertisement in the country and also in the website, and the users could find all the information that they need to know before to apply and try to register an IDN domain name. And we also provide to the users the web browsers that run correctly IDN. So most of the complainants, for example, not really complainant, but the people that doesn't like this system is because their clients hasn't have the browsers updated. So that was the reason why they say, well, my client doesn't see me. But it's not the reason, it's not the IDN, the reason is the browser. So we put on the website everything that you could you can get the update to of the browsers, including Explorer, because since the beginning, when IDNs start to run in the internet, Mozilla, Opera, almost the open source websites, clients, web clients, could work quite well with IDNs. So when they were disappointed at the beginning, they normally use both. The number of them without IDN and the IDN domain name correctly speaking in the language, like Vinya, for example, with Enye, but also Bina, which is the not IDN letter, is the N. So they forward the website and the domain names to the same place. So the clients, the consumers can see them by Vinya or by Bina, and they got the same place. But yes, the answer is yes. We did this very well, and it's very interesting because in the community of the CCTLDs, IDN's domain names are no more than 3% of the domain names in the registries.
Very interesting. Again, I will wait for a question from the floor again, because I still have questions. No, it's a very interesting thing, and the question is about the NIC model again. Do you work on registrar model, or it's only a registry? Or do you have registrar?
We have we are working on it to have an EBP protocol in order to work with model registrar. Right now we are the registry and the registrar at the same time, and one of the reasons is that the market is not so big, so it wasn't necessary up to now to split the operation.
Okay. Thank you.
Tajikistan, maybe they are there.
Are people from Tajikistan here? Because they were supposed to present their best practice too. No. Seems they have just give up.
Maybe are in the beach.
Yeah, probably. Thank you very much. So to wrap up, I think the model from Chile is a very liberal model with very little intervention from the government. And from what I've seen, NIC Chile, with the university, are taking the lead in this, with the support of the government and their community. We have also seen a very interesting way of how government can enforce law, which will allow internet development by, for instance, making service level transparent, forcing ISP or pushing ISP to connect together to have a local exchange point, and not only for small but also for big ISP, so that end user can get benefit from the speed. So I think it's something very interesting, and we hope that from this best practice sharing, it can emulate some good idea in other country, other developing country, and specifically in Africa. One recommendation or one thing which I will say is that we should go further into the best practice sharing by engaging into more collaboration, South-South collaboration, as you say, so that we can also learn, or other country can learn from those very beautiful and successful experience. Thank you very much for the presentation, and thank you, everybody.
Services provided privately, then it's the logical consequence that the management of domain names is privately provided too. But one might ask, why is it NIC-AT? Well, NIC-AT was provided without any governmental interference. And governmental interference was not necessary since it perfectly worked. And, well, of course, there is only one registry possible. It's the Highlander effect, as I call it. There is only one possible. So it's clear you only can have one registry for each CCTLD, and there is no competition possible. How would that work? Somebody must be the boss. Somebody must organize the primary directory. So it's clear only it could be one registry, and NIC-AT was here, and they do their job quite well. And since the management of the internet is organized privately, then it's clear that DNS should only be organized privately too. What's the governmental view? Well, I said I'm a lazy person, so never touch a running system. Why should I change anything? Why should the government change anything? So someday the government realized, oh my God, there is something like the internet. We didn't use that before, but now we realize we are using it heavily. We are heavily dependent on that. But thanks God, it works. Thanks God, there is somebody who takes care of the internet. Thanks God, there is the local internet community who looks after the internet and provides a stable service. So we had no reason to interfere, and we restricted our activity to some sort of supervision, some sort of coordination, some sort of discussion, and, well, the instrument of discussing that is the Domain Name Council. I will explain to you in the next slide. And since we have huge support from the local internet community for that model, and since via the mean of NetID, NIC-AT serves the public interests, we also don't see to change anything. Well, the Domain Name Council is the advisory board, is the talking platform where we get the information from NIC-AT and where we try to influence the policy of NIC-AT. It consists of registrars, of lawyers, of international experts. So the local internet community is well represented within the Domain Name Council. And we give advice. We developed an arbitration procedure. We helped develop the general policy. The introduction of IDN was broadly discussed within the Domain Name Council. So, summary. I've got 30 seconds. Fact one, no legislation is possible. Fact two, we have a very excellent relationship between NIC-AT and the government. It's a private bottom-up self-administration and the broad support from the local internet community. NetIT serves public interests, and all stakeholders are happy. So, last point, why should we change anything? The answer is no, there is no reason for that. So I hope I was on time. Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to your questions afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you, Christian Singer. I would now like to ask Hiro Hotta to present .jp.
Thank you. Where's mine?
Do you want to have a look, Pete?
JP2. I think this is the one.
Yeah.
Yes. Let's see. I think I should try on this.
Good morning. My name is Hiro Hotta from JPRS, the .jp CCTLD. Let me give you a brief introduction on the .jp governance. Okay, this is the history of .jp management. In 1986, it's around 21 years ago, .jp was delegated to an individual who was a university professor, Jun Murai. And in 1993, JPNIC, Japan Network Information Center, was established as a government-approved, membership-based, non-profit organization. And Jun Murai was the president of that and started managing .jp. In 2000, maybe many of you remember that the in around 2000, there was a dot-com boom. And .jp was, in Japanese market, .jp was in competition with .com. And the JPNIC thought about the privatization of .jp management because the this kind of government-approved not-for-profit organization has less flexibility in doing business, such as they cannot borrow money from somewhere. So it's a Japanese regulation. So it was not easy to invest their on their system forward. So JPNIC thought about that, and its General Assembly resolved the establishment of a new company as a private for-profit company. That was us, the JPRS. And in 2002, January, the government endorsed us as manager for .jp-TLD. And we agreed with JPNIC for a transfer of .jp management formally. And in February 2002, CCTLD sponsorship agreement for .jp with the ICANN was executed. This means that we are one of the very few CCTLD organizations, managers, who agrees with ICANN in a formal contract form. And in April that year, the transfer of .jp management's responsibility and operation from JPNIC to JPRS completed. This means that the re-delegation is completed. It was a long way to make this re-delegation. Maybe it took around 1.5 years. And this is a framework of .jp management and administration. It's a little bit complex. This is me, JPRS. And we have sponsorship agreement with ICANN. And JPNIC, which is a former manager of .jp, oversees us I'm sorry. It's going. Oversees us with through consultation with the government. Oversee means that they are checking constantly that whether JPRS is doing a good management on .jp. So this is the contract with JPNIC, between JPNIC and JPRS. So government is, as you see, the government is one step away through the JPNIC from us. So we don't have a direct relationship with the government. This means that we don't have contractual relationship with the government. And also, there is no regulation law on the internet, about the internet in Japan. So we are not regulated by the government as a domain name manager. Of course, we are a private sector company, so there's a usual law governing us, but no law for the internet or domain name.
And JPNIC is a public, private?
Yes, and the JPNIC is a semi-public, semi-private organization, which is membership-based, which is approved by the government. So JPNIC has members from the business sector, usually business sector like ISPs or hosting providers, and some vendors. So anybody can join JPNIC. So through JPNIC, the communication can oversee us. This is a mechanism how a community in Japan can oversee us. So we have advisory committee, which is for the .jp, I'm sorry, for .jp policy. And of course, many people, at this moment, I think 6 people from the community joins the advisory committee, like business sector, academy, ISPs, registrars, and something. And of course, consumers. But there's no government representative in our advisory committee. And we have communication with the community through annual report, website, and something. And of course, we meet with our DNS managers, meeting with registrars, and we do education activities to the community. This is how the management of .jp works. As you see, the .jp governance, we have no contractual relationships with the government, no specific governing law for the internet operation, as I said, and government supports private sector-driven internet governance. This is their basic attitude. And oversight of .jp management, it's under the contract between JPRS and JPNIC. JPNIC oversees the .jp management with reporting or consulting with the government. And JPNIC is a not-for-profit community-based membership organization which anybody can join. An autonomous effort in .jp management, of course, we have to, we should serve for the community. So we do some autonomous effort even if there's no governing law or a contract. So openness and transparency. We have advisory committee. We have annual registry report issued. And of course, we release press releases and announces about major activities. And high service quality, security and stability, of course. And spontaneous observation of telecommunication business guidelines set by government and the industry group. There's some telecommunication business guidelines which is applied for usually the telephone operators, but we spontaneously or autonomously observe the guidelines. And we do registry data escrow in case
we fail.
And community service. We lead projects for healthy use of domain names and DNS. And we educate of DNS, internet, through conferences, websites, mailing lists. And we operate one of the root servers, which is M root server. Advisory committee. Maybe I've already explained this. And it's open and transparent. Observers welcome, and documents and detailed minutes posted on website. This is the last slide. Summary. .jpcctlt manager, JPRS, is a private for-profit company with no contractual relationship with the government. But the government endorses the activities of JPRS by publicizing an endorsement letter and keeps endorsing us through observation of the activities of us. And JPRS serves the interest of the internet community through autonomous effort in accord with the basic policy principles of the Japanese government. So private sector-driven internet governance. That's one sentence of the .jp management. Thank you.
Thank you, Hiro. We now get a presentation from one of the more recent registries, URIT4.eu. Mark?
With pleasure.
I think you need to get out of here, probably.
This one?
Yeah. Twice.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. My name is Mark van Wezemaal. I have four slides, so it will be a short introduction to what the .eu is and in what it differs from the rest of my colleagues around the table. To start the discussion, I would like to give you a little introduction in the timeline of how .eu came into being. It was an initiative started by the European Commission in 1999, was taken up in the eEurope initiative in March 2000. In 2002, there was a regulation that defined that there should be a .eu top-level domain. Next, there came a request for expression of interests where the candidates to run that .eu could enter their files, their applications, and URIT was chosen in 2003. It is a five-year contract that is renewable for the same period. Afterwards, there was a regulation, again in 2004, that laid down the public policy rules concerning the implementation and functioning of the .eu, which means the rules to register a domain name, who can register a domain name, and what should the domain name look like. The registry started operations on 7th of December 2005 with the Sunrise, and open registrations for everybody on April the 7th. I'll come back to this. This is the timeline. The content, I would like to build up the contractual relationship that URIT has with the European Commission in this slide. First of all, this, as expanded in the previous slide, we had the regulation in 2002 that said already that the registry should be a non-profit organization, that it should have the registry registrar model with no direct registrations and with a contract with registrars, that a public policy must be created by the European Commission assisted by the COCOM, the Communication Committee, and it should only be for residents of the European Union. There was also to be an exception list with geographical and geopolitical names, and provisions for a phased registration should be provided, which is the famous Sunrise, which allowed users of certain rights to register their names up front. And lastly, there had to be an ADR, alternative dispute resolution procedure. This was laid down in the first regulation in 2002, before any candidate was chosen or before even any application was sent in. As it was said in the timeline, after the manager was chosen, in this case Jurid, the second regulation was put together by the EC, by the European Commission, and the member states in consultation with the chosen manager of the TLD. It defines the principles: who can register a name, who are the registrars, who can be a registrar, what should the phased registrations look like, what is the alternative dispute resolution, which are the reserved and blocked names, what about bona vacantia, which is when a name becomes available because the owner dies, for instance, and the registration procedures, that is a first-come, first-served principle. Then Jurid and the Commission concluded a concession contract, and this makes the framework, the legal framework, within which Jurid can work. In that work, it is supervised by the European Commission, so to see whether Jurid is doing its work within that legal framework. But on the other hand, the European Commission is also supervised, and I'm not a specialist in European structures, but it's supervised by the European Parliament and the Council of European Union, which in their function are elected by the European citizens and the stakeholders in Europe. So indirectly, we have the whole citizenship of Europe taking part in what has become the manager of the .eu TLD. On the other hand, Jurid has a strategic committee that advises the board on matters as policy that, of course, are limited within the framework of the legal regulations. This strategic committee consists of stakeholders and are currently ISOC, the Business Europe, which is the Federation of Federations of Companies, and the members of Jurid, which are the five registries from Belgium, Sweden, Italy, Slovenia, and the Czech Republic. And it's open for other stakeholder groups. So this is basically the model that Jurid works in. We think that that model is quite successful because we had a successful Sunrise, a model that has on which the new .asia has based their own Sunrise model. The land rush was on 7 April 2006 very successful, with 3 million transactions in the course of about 12 hours. With more than 1 million new domain names registered in the first day, and with a maximum of transactions per minute, 8,416, or that is, on average, during that minute, 140 transactions per second. So it was quite a heavy load and a big interest from the market. The model is showing sustained growth and growing use of the .eu. More than 2.6 million names are registered for the moment, and the .eu is currently number 8 in the world. there is a continued interest with more than 2,800 now, even going up to 3,000 new registrations a day. And the Europeans have started to perceive the added value of .eu. And that we can see by the growing numbers of DNS queries on our name servers. About 82% of the domain names resolve to a real email address or a website, which is quite high in usage terms. And we see a growing number of .eus in the streets, in the advertising, either in little advertising or in big ones. So, to conclude my presentation, it is a successful model with a working dispute resolution procedure, registrars in more than 40 countries, full service in all and support in all official European languages, and a code of conduct that has been implemented and which is based on self-regulations by the registrars. And one comment is that we seem to have a quite rigid legal framework with these regulations and contract, but we consider that as having a stabilizing effect on our business, because we don't have this continued discussions about things that should change, because people know that we are bound by the regulations. There might be a potential danger that the rigid framework, legal framework, affects flexibility, because if things would have to change, we might have to change the regulations. But the model has been made such that it leaves a lot of room for further initiative and development and has not been limiting up till now, according to our experience. Well, that's my introduction.
Thank you, Mark. I'm sure the audience would like to know more about how this complex regulation affects your everyday work. But before we discuss these things, we get our last presentation from Margarita Valdez about .cl.
Hello, my name is Margarita Valdez. I'm from Chile. I'm from the registry for .cl, that is a country code in Chile. Sorry. And I will show you the experience of operating .cl inside the university. This is in .cl was delegated to the Department of Computer Science of the University of Chile in 1987. We operate without formal registration in that days, any agreement, and without fees for 10 years. About 1,000 registered domain names in 1997 we had. That was the day that we had a formalization in September. Rules that we introduced in 1997. In informal times, people just ask us, I want to use this kind of domain name, and we put it in a list. But after 1997, we asked a proper identification of the registrants. There was an until now registration fees, re-registration for all pre-existing domain names. We installed the dispute resolution policy based on arbitration, and it's a very interesting point because it was 2 years before the uniform dispute resolution policy it was working. And our local dispute resolution policy later extended to include mediation before arbitration. Why is .cl so popular? Few restrictions on who can register and what can be registered. Minimal bureaucracy at time of registration. The conflicts handled through dispute resolution policy. It's a proper local dispute resolution policy. The registration at second level. It's just under .cl. So the address, the domain names are short and easy to work with that. The work is hard to offer good quality of service, good customer support, diversity in means of payment, free services like mediation, secondary DNS services, and low registration fees. How we are we have involvement with the community. In October 2000, an advisory board was created to discuss and make recommendations about the policy for registrations under .cl. The board included a variety of members of the community and two undersecretaries from the government, telecommunications and economy. Several policies changes were made on the advice of this board. The advisory board ceased operating in September 2003. In its final meeting, we approved the recommendation that .cl should join DCSNSO. We also agreed to run IDN in 2007 in the next step that we will see. Right, no, sorry, 2005, I'm sorry. We are organizing with the government an early response net involving ISPs, with NIC Chile, universities, and governmental entities. After this advisory board, we got the National Council of Domain Names and IP Addresses. It was created in June 2003 by decree of the Ministry of Telecommunications, met for the first time on April 2004. The mission of this council is to provide recommendations about policy. The members are representatives of the community, industry, business, IPs, ISPs, academics, and etc., and government, telecommunications and economy, and NIC Chile, which is Provas the Secretariat. A users association is also being invited, but they are not organized yet. The council may be extended by the incorporation of new members if they want to apply. Topics in the current agenda include online dispute resolution policy, WHOIS, and IPv6. Conclusions: is it possible to run a CCTLD inside the university? Yes, but it's a lot of work, especially when University of Chile is a kind of public entity, and we have a lot of controls, like over many of the governmental entities in Chile. It is possible to be in connection with the local internet community, and we often made seminars and conferences to share this information or technical issues with the community. We are frequently working with the government, providing advice on matters such as regulations about incarnations of ISPs. And it is possible to develop initiatives from the registry to the community, like, for example, IPv6 transition. And that's it. Thank you.
How many people are working for NIC Chile?
34 people.
Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. I would like now give the floor to the audience. Questions, comments? Yes, please.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Matthias Treimer. I'm here as a delegate from the Council of Europe. The Council of Europe's agenda and ICT agenda, you might have seen at various workshops here that it is, of course, closely linked to the enforcement of human rights, and that's the reason why in the Council of Europe, and especially also in a recent recommendation of the Committee of Ministers from November 2007, it's called the Public Service Value of the Internet Recommendation. We had a look of different developments, and there was also asked a question, a workshop yesterday, why we did not definitely or especially refer to the question of domain names in this recommendation, and there was a discussion if that what your services that you just presented to us have a so-called public service value. What I would, in principle, of course, say yes. The question is, and to make it clear, the recommendation endorses very much exactly the models that you have presented, that private companies provide the public with this public service value without any interference of the state. Nonetheless, there is also the Council of Europe's perspective that if the state delegates public services to private companies, finally there should be some accountability of the state if there is a conflict with human rights, like, for example, freedom of expression. So how would you see the role then of the state if, for example, there's a problem when with a registration, somebody wants a domain name for whatever reason.
Could you keep it a bit short?
Yeah, for whatever reason, he does not succeed in getting this domain name. How would you say then the responsibility of the registrar? Thank you.
Thank you. From what I understand, you ask specifically about the role of accountability, how that is sort of managed on
yes.
the. Who would like to pick this question up?
I could say a few words, but I'm probably the worst person to answer this question because we have this accountability framework with the European Commission that is supervising us. But I think the interesting part is for those who said that they have little or interaction with the state, that how they work with your question or how they answer your question.
What about GPRS?
Yes, I think the about the relationship with the government, we do annual report to JPNIC, and they are a kind of doing assessment on our activity continuously whole year. So I think it's the a kind of mechanism for the accountability. Maybe I misunderstood your question, but when there's a kind of activities or problems on which may maybe against the human rights or something, as a registrar or a registrar of the domain name, we are not. We think that we are not responsible for how the domain names are used or how what the domain name string means. It's not our matter. So the police or the court order may move us when such things happen.
Okay, thank you. Austria also wants to reply. Please keep it short. There are more questions to come so that we have a more lively discussion.
Just a few words to the question of Matthias Treimer from the Council of Europe. Well, we've got a legal framework for almost everything. So if there is a case of domain grabbing or if there is a case of infringing with human rights, and we had a case which was quite politically sensitive, there is the ordinary legal framework. There are the judges, there are the courts who proceed, and then NIC-AT, well, it's not exempt from the law. Then NIC-AT has to respect what everything is based on the legal framework. So far, we didn't have any problem with the private management of the registry on the one hand and the legal framework in Austria, on the other hand. It worked so far perfectly well.
Okay, now we have a question from .nl.
Yeah, Roelof Meijer from .nl. I have a question for Hero. Hero, it's not that often that a CCTLD registry is a fully... I hear myself, but... Is it better like this? Okay. It's not that often that a CCTLD registry is a for-profit organization. And I missed some of the of the structure, the oversight structure between JPRS and JPNIC. But my first question would be, how do you set your prices? And what happens to the surplus?
Okay, thank you. The policy, including the price, is set by us, the JPRS. We don't consult with the JPNIC or the government. But the market will decide whether our price is appropriate or not.
Really?
How I mean, there's not so much competition. And what do you do with the surplus? Do you have shareholders? Or
We have shareholders. And our shareholders are very special because we negotiate them. They don't want to have money, earn money. So they do want to have...
they only want to have a share.
Yes. It's not
sounds like a miracle to me.
Our stocks is not open to the market. And the shareholders... know the concept of the internet, how the internet infrastructure is vital to the society. So they don't want to earn money.
Can I ask again? My understanding is you do a monopoly service, right? How can the market then sort of have any impact on the price-setting mechanism? Is it that people run away to other registries if the prices are too high, or how does the market work?
I don't think we are. We do a monopoly because we compete with very many TLDs, so market will decide.
Okay. Next is Martin Boyle.
Private sector will go to the government.
Thank you, Roloff. And of course, I recognize the magnanimity of the private sector coming to the public. Martin Boyle from the UK government. I've got a question specifically aimed at Austria, because I think the UK government approach to the registry and the Austrian government approach to their registry is actually very, very similar. And I'd like actually then to link that to supplement Christian's response to the Council of Europe. Within the UK, there is no formal relationship and, in fact, no formal recognition by the United Kingdom government of Nominet as the .uk registry. It just happens. There was one specific amendment that was made, and again, very similar, it sounds to me, to the Austrian case, that we removed the domain name system from the Communications Act, which was about the numbering, and therefore we were treating it as separate to telephony. My question to Christian is whether in Austria there is some formal recognition by the government of the registry, and if so, why you decided that that was necessary, and if not, why you decided that that was not necessary. So I'm not going to let you off the hook. And then the second part of my intervention was directly associated with the accountability of a private organisation, and I think Christian's answer is exactly right. We have a legal structure, and that has to be responded to. But I think within the UK we have got an accountability to the stakeholders as well, where within the UK system the stakeholders are actually directly involved in that process, and that the framework that is put in place includes then dispute resolution procedures, which one would hope would kick in before we got to a state where somebody was having to take actual law, actual legal response. And therefore, perhaps a question back to the Council of Europe is why they would think it would be necessary for governments to take a more active control and role over the infrastructure to achieve something that actually works offline quite well. Thank you.
Well, the answer, is there a recognition and what's the reason for the situation? Well, it's quite simple. No, there is no formal recognition, and the answer is it was not necessary.
Emily, do you want to... Okay, then there was another question there at the back. Canada.
I'm feeling like an alien. But I will try to put the country code top-level domains in the context of countries, right? Because I imagine that one day in future there is we will have to be a correspondence between the reality and the virtuality. And that's the function of the domains. So the question to the table is exactly that. What would be the vision of you that you are operating this reality of country code top-level domains to the next 100 years of internet, right? I don't know if I make clear my question. The future vision of the correspondence between countries, reality of the countries, the mix between public and private domains, the sphere of public domains, the sphere of, like you have in the law, for example, in the law, a century, a millionaire knowledge of humanity, we have the private and the public domain, right? So in terms of technology, how the country code top-level domain will correspond to a more balanced equivalence between the reality, the real country, and the virtual country that is represented by the country code top-level domain right now.
Is that clear?
My question?
Would you like to address it to somebody specifically?
No, to anyone who wants or that have think about that point.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not sure if I understand it really correct, but I'll try to answer. I think the local TLD is an anchor in the worldwide internet structure, and I think the business, the registry business and the internet business is more and more, let's say, a normal business in our what we do. In the past, we had a lot of gray zone in the legal situation, and I think also in the technician space, it's more and more clear, and every registry works professional around the world. So, regarding your question, what is the interaction between virtual and real world, I think the business based on internet or on domain names becomes more and more important for the country, for the country code, and for the internet in that specific countries.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Now .ca.
Thank you. My name's Heather Dryden. I'm with the Canadian Department of Industry. I'm not with .ca, so let me be very clear. My question is really to those that have membership-based organizations or members in some sense of that meaning. CIRA, for example, has members and also is accountable to the general internet community. It's declared a public resource, the .ca. So Is there a way you differentiate between sort of the registrants and someone that you describe as a member? Are they getting something extra? Is there a particular benefit to that?
Are you asking all of them, or would you...
Those that have membership-based organizations or
that would have something to comment on.
If we could be seen as memberships, and in fact, URIT was created by five registries, which in your terminology could be the members of the organization, as it is a non-profit organization. They are themselves registries for their own countries, and there is no any benefit or whatsoever. They just... I think as a board, they more advise the management of the company just to with their expertise in running TLDs. But for registering domain names or whatsoever, there is no benefit at all.
Hiro, do you also want to comment on this one? Mm-hmm. There is another question in the back.
I'm Al Alegre from the Philippines, .ph, which is a bit controversial, over the past 5 years. My question is to anyone. In the Philippines, there is one registrar performs both registry and registrar functions. So I don't know if many in the Philippines believe that there are conflict of interest questions involved. I'm not sure if within the CCTLD community there is a view that there are instances where it is best practice to have the marriage between the registry function, keeping the root zone files, etc., and registering, because it is de facto monopoly. There are sort of sub-registrants, but they cannot go beyond a certain price. Is there in the practice instances where this type of arrangement is good? And the second question, since we are in the IGF and it's a governance, I'm wondering, I'm not too familiar with the community of CCTLD administrators. And I just want to know, because given that that's a situation in the Philippines and there might be similar, what are the internal governance sort of mechanisms to sort of do some self-regulation about registrars or registries that have problems, or is that sort of like off limits to others? Because that's your own backyard. We will not. Mm-hmm. Are there any instances where other registries or the community mm-hmm. will say that, "Hey, this is not best practice. This is actually there are very serious public interests." Questions involved.
So do I understand this correctly? The second question refers to potential drawbacks of self-regulatory mechanisms?
No, just to see if within the current governance or self-governing sort of group of administrators within the ICANN structure, is what are the mechanisms if a member has serious public interest sort of debates happening, do other... Do co-members have the opportunity or the inclination to sort of perform community co-regulatory functions to tell the erring registry that there are problems with how it's running in particular countries?
Maybe I'm not sure that I fully understood your question, but if one member or organization would be dominant in the regulatory process, I would doubt that self-regulatory is the right word to use then, and probably then there is something wrong with the model. I think in most cases that I know of, self-regulatory is working well because there are no dominant positions that define their agenda.
Maybe I wasn't clear. It's, for example, there's a group of all the registries are grouped together in an association, right? And if the majority feel that there is a problem with how one is being run. Are there mechanisms within that organization to sort of take that erring organization to question it, or mm-hmm. just an inquiry or an investigation?
I think, I hope I catch it. There are regional organizations all over the world, for example, Center in Europe and a little bit broader there in South America and in Asia-Pacific area. And this regional organization normally discuss problems, set up best practice papers, position papers, and educate and exchange information under registries. That means that we have success stories or we discuss problems and everything what is on our normal business. So, yes, there is an education and information exchange between registries just to educate them and inform them.
But you see the governance problem here, because it's like, for example, I'm a member of the ASEAN, Philippines,
yeah?
And we have a member, Burma. Yeah.
What is a member in your
like in the for example, it's like the parallel of an intergovernmental agency like ASEAN.
Okay.
And then there's an erring member, but there's a policy of non-intervention. So nobody can really say that even though there's something happening in that country.
I'm afraid you have to take this question offline and discuss it, because we've really reached now the end of our time and I see people leaving. So
okay,
I don't want
I'm
to be
sorry.
Impolite, but I think we need to conclude now. I really like this discussion. There are lots of questions we couldn't really address. For example, further changes people foresee with regard to their registries. But what we probably could show quite well is that there are different models to be successful in this area. So I thank you very much for attending this session. I also want to thank our panelists, and I wish you a nice day and a good way home. Thank you very much.